is Mr. Bolvar.
Good morning to you, sir.
Mr. List, you're with us also. Either council have any questions before we begin?
I do not.
No, Your Honor.
Very good. Mr. Bolvar, you may approach. And
thank you. I would reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Just 1 second before everybody gets in their chairs. Which now has largely taken place.
You have a better view than I do, sir.
That's right.
Thank you. May it please the court and council, all the law students here today. There are four issues on direct appeal. One that I would like to address first and foremost is the issue of the district court deciding to allow one incriminating statement to be heard by the jury and several other exculpatory statements by defendant appellant that the jury was not allowed to hear.
Did you take the position before the district court that the first few statements were exculpatory? Or did you sweep all of those into the Jackson v. Dental argument that you presented below?
I was not in front of the district court. There's two issues. There's the Jackson versus Deno issue on whether these were voluntary or involuntary statements. There was a Jackson versus Deno hearing. The court found that some of the statements were involuntary and did not allow those. The second part of this is under Nebraska Evidence Law 27-106, where the argument that was made in the trial court and that I am making on appeal is under the rule of completeness, that if the trial court is letting in one of these statements, then both of them or all of them should have been let in. Does that answer your question?
I understood you to be arguing that some of those statements were exculpatory, and I didn't see anything like that kind of an argument presented.
Well, yes, I do believe that some of the statements were exculpatory. Officer Kliegel was asking the appellant questions specifically about.
Those wouldn't have been confessions if you're saying those were exculpatory statements.
Well, it goes to the element of both of the charges, the DUI and to the driving under revocation. So essentially, the officer is asking appellant if there's someone else in the car. So the argument is that there was someone else in the car. The jury should have been able to hear this, and they were not able to hear this.
Did the jury hear anything about someone else being in the car?
I don't believe the jury heard.
The officer testify.
The officer did testify as to the officer's impressions of what the statements were, which were in Exhibit 8.
So did the officer testify that he asked your client whether there was someone in the car, and your client responded in a grunt or?
That's correct. The officer
interpreted that as a yes?
The officer, yes, and this goes to the state's harmless error argument.
So that was before the jury.
It was before the jury. Kliegel's testimony that appellant grunted towards a yes. That's not the same as Exhibit 8, where Kliegel's understanding of what appellant said, clearly by his interactions with dispatch and LFR, was that he didn't know if there was anyone else in the vehicle. That appellant said both that there was someone and then later that there wasn't someone.
So Exhibit 8 would have been clear to the jury of your client's response to that question?
I think it's something certainly they could have considered, yes. I think it was clear to Kliegel, so I think it could have been clear to the jury as well.
Thank you.
As to the harmless error, the state does assert again that Kliegel's statement got in, and this is even better than hearing Exhibit 8. Well, it's not better. It's Kliegel's interpretation of what happened. Hearing actually what happened is, I believe, what the jury should have heard. So by only hearing one statement and not the other statements, I think that, well, certainly the totality of circumstances couldn't be considered by the jury. They're instructed in jury instruction number 11 on what to consider. They can't consider the totality of the circumstances. They can only consider what they're shown, of course, which was the one statement. So I don't believe it was harmless error. The language of harmless error, is the guilty verdict surely unattributable to the error, this being the district court's error to only allow the one statement. I don't think you can say this. The state clearly relied on that one statement, both during direct and during closing. This is something emphasized by the state at trial to the jury. Defense counsel was not allowed to discuss this, was not allowed to bring it up, tried to bring it up one time. And of course, that question was objected to and sustained. It's not allowed to bring this up in closing arguments, so the jury couldn't consider what was actually said at the scene and interpreted by Officer Klegel in a manner that the jury could have similarly interpreted. So this is not harmless error. Certainly, I think under 27106, if you let one of the statements in, then you let all of them in, because I think the premise here that the district court is going on is that, well, I can't really tell what the communication is on some of these, but you can on this other one. So that's why this one comes in and nothing else comes in. But
so the court determined it on a clarity issue or a
court
excluding that first statement?
The court did not expound much on their decision. They said this one's voluntary, everything else is involuntary, and then said, yeah, when they were having the discussion, the judge made the decision, redacted.
Did the court say that the first few statements that seemed more like grunts and moans were simply unintelligible?
I don't recall the specific words of the court as to what those grunts and moans were. Apologize for that, but I remember that the analysis was very brief.
Tell me how grunts and moans are the sorts of statements that Jackson v. Deno is addressing.
Well, Jackson v. Deno addresses voluntariness versus involuntariness. So is a voluntary statement? A voluntary statement. We all understand what those things mean. Officer Klegel understood what those things mean.
Was there any evidence in our record of police coercion, any coercive activity at the scene of the accident in and around the time that those grunts and moans were made?
Well, coercion in the sense that the officer was exerting influence. This is someone that is unconscious, coming in and out of consciousness, someone whose will could be overborne. So in the sense that the officer, at the extreme end, coercion is, the thumb screws, absolutely not. The officer was clearly there wearing several hats. The officer is there for medical assistance, for helping someone that's injured. But at the same time, there's a criminal investigation going on. This is why we're here today, is the questions that were asked of Pellant. Essentially, were you alone in the vehicle? And the state's argument is he's alone in the vehicle, an element of each of the charges. So at the same time that he's calling LFR, he's also doing a police investigation. And coercion, in the sense that he's exerting influence by asking questions of essentially an unconscious person who, in that state, whether he knows even what he's saying, I don't know. So
I beg your pardon, sir. And partly in the interest of time, would you like to address the issue of the blood draw and the Birchfield issue and what's an exigent circumstance? Thank you.
In the interest of time, I have 1 minute and 20 seconds left. So I will leave that to what I've put in my brief. And would like to reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellate, state of Nebraska. Miller raises four claims on appeal. The two claims I intend to focus on are the denial of the motion to suppress and the admission of the statements from the accident scene, or the statement from the accident scene. I was going to start with the denial of the motion to suppress, but since the prior discussion focused primarily on the admission of the statement from the accident scene, I'll start there. As far as the admission of Miller's statements from the accident scene, there are two questions before this court. Number one, was the statement that was admitted at trial voluntary and admissible? And number two, once that statement was admitted, was the defense entitled to introduce other statements that Miller made at the statement of the scene under the rule of completeness? As far as that first question, whether the admitted statement was voluntary, we maintain that it was voluntary and properly admitted. As set forth in our brief, under Jackson v. Deno and subsequent case law, a statement or an admission is involuntary and inadmissible only if there has been, only if it's a product of coercive police activity. In this case, as set forth in our brief, and as the record reflects, there was no coercive police activity whatsoever here. So we would submit that his statements were not involuntary and there was no basis to suppress or exclude his statements on such grounds.
How do you respond to Mr. Mulvar's argument that the officer here was wearing several hats? He was the medical rescuer, and he was also doing a police investigation at the same time. How does that affect the issue of coerciveness in the Jackson Deno argument?
Well, I think if anything, that bodes in our favor, because I think his primary objective upon arrival at the scene is to figure out medically what is going on here, what assistance do we need, as opposed to simply pursuing an investigation, trying to, as these cases deal with, overreach and obtain incriminating information. That really wasn't his objective, at least not primarily. So I think that bodes in our favor to the extent that he's not seeking that information, and it doesn't render his statements legally involuntary. In our view, the Jackson v. Deno motion was properly denied with respect to that statement.
With regard to the portion of the statement that was not allowed to come in, what was the basis for the, what was the state's understanding for the basis of that part of the recording not to be?
My understanding, my recollection is akin to what Justice Stacy relayed, that the district court found that it really wasn't all that clear, that it was unintelligible and therefore involuntary. With
voluntariness discussion, though, can't the defendant waive that portion of it and allow it to come in if it's just his motion to actually be in a motion and it's his voluntariness that's under question? Couldn't he just waive that portion and allow it to come in if that's the basis?
With respect to their motion, sure. I mean, I think they could have.
Did he try to do that before the district court?
Yeah, there was some back and forth, and because the parties below both agreed that all of these statements should either all come in or none should come in. And so the defense did, pursue that, and then ultimately the court kind of went back and forth. Initially, the court said, well, I'm finding only this one to be voluntary, and the defense said, well, just to clarify, does that mean we can bring in the remainder? And the court said, well, I'm not precluding you from doing anything. I'm just making a ruling on which statement I find voluntary. And then they revisited the issue at trial as trial commenced, and they sought further clarification on what could come in and what could not come in. And the court then said, no, this is the only statement I'm letting in. So I guess, yes, I would say the defense did seek to do that.
So did the district court err in that second ruling?
With all due respect to the district court, I think the court was wrong to exclude the initial statement. I don't think any of those statements were involuntary, not legally under Jackson v. Deno, and I'm not aware of any other authority that would have rendered those legally involuntary and inadmissible, at least under this analysis. So I think they all should have come in.
Intelligible or unintelligible.
Right. Right. Unless there was some other basis for an objection, if it was a 103 or something else by the state, perhaps, but under this analysis, I think they all should have come in, which brings us to the next question of where does that leave us? In my opinion, I don't see any need to get to the rule of completeness, because I think from a Jackson v. Deno standpoint, they all should have come in that under that analysis alone, and we don't even need to turn to the rule of completeness. The question is whether or not the exclusion of that statement is harmless, and we maintain that it is, in light of the fact that the evidence that was, or the statement that Miller sought to bring in did ultimately come in through Officer Kliegel. As set forth in our brief, Officer Kliegel, when he first arrived at the scene, he went up and spoke with Mr. Miller, asked if anyone else had been in the vehicle. He heard what Miller grunted, which Officer Kliegel, said he understood to be a yes or towards a yes. He then looked around the scene, didn't find anyone else, went back to Mr. Miller again and asked if anyone had been in the vehicle, and he got a more definitive no that time. But the initial statement, which is the one that Miller sought to admit, did effectively come in through Officer Kliegel's testimony. So we would maintain that any error with the district court's ruling is harmless. Just briefly, as far as the appellant's assertion that Officer Kliegel's testimony was not good enough here because Exhibit 8 was much more clear, I respectfully disagree. I listened to that exhibit several times, and I frankly didn't hear anything other than grunting. So I think the testimony that they were able to get out of Officer Kliegel was much more beneficial than that exhibit would have been. If there are no further questions,
I beg your pardon. I do have a question, and I'm not sure that your arguments or appellant's arguments are addressing this. And maybe this is not a problem whatsoever. Is there some tension between the Jackson-Denno universe of voluntariness versus medical treatment evidentiary rules?
Not to my knowledge. And to the extent there would be, their claim below was Jackson v. Denno. I mean, that was their motion. That was their basis to seek it out, or to exclude it and have it kept out. So they didn't seek
so
it.
So our appellate review is going to be, I beg your pardon, yes, our appellate review is going to be circumscribed by the manner in which this was tried. And that was under the Jackson v. Denno theory. Is that correct?
Yeah, our appellate review would be limited to the manner in which it was raised below, as well as the manner in which it has been assigned and argued on appeal, which is presented as a Jackson v. Denno issue and then a rule of completeness issue.
I see. And also, if I may, opposing counsel's doesn't seem interested in addressing the blood draw and exigent circumstances. Do you have any interest in addressing that?
Going to briefly move into that next. As far as the denial of the motion to suppress, we maintain it was properly denied because the blood draw in this case was lawfully obtained without a warrant under the exigent circumstances exception. As set forth in our brief, the U.S. Supreme Court's recent decision in Mitchell v. Wisconsin explains that exigent circumstances exist in drunk driving cases when someone's BAC is dissipating and when there are some other factors that create pressing health, safety, or law enforcement needs that are more important than obtaining a warrant. The court in Mitchell went on to explain that both these requirements are satisfied in certain situations. One such situation, as in Mitchell, is when a suspected drunk driver is unconscious and the need for medical treatment basically trumps the need to get a warrant because that would frustrate the ability to get the medical treatment that they need, or vice versa. And then another situation, as in Schmerber, is when a suspect's been in a motor vehicle accident in which alcohol is suspected to be a factor, and requiring law enforcement to get a warrant would impair their need to deal with the more pressing needs of the accident itself. In this case, both those circumstances were present. Mr. Miller was involved in a motor vehicle accident in which alcohol was suspected to be a factor, and he was unconscious and in need of immediate medical treatment upon his arrival at the hospital. The exigencies of Mitchell and Schmerber were both present here, so we maintain that the blood draw was lawfully obtained without a warrant, and the motion to suppress was properly denied.
Miller's argument that there was adequate time to get a warrant, a judge was available, there's a substation at the hospital to draft the document. How do those arguments fit in?
Mitchell addressed those and said, you know, technology has come a long way. We have really expedited the ability to get warrants, but that doesn't change the fact, that doesn't change the legal framework of whether or not this qualifies as an exigent circumstances, and it does. This is precisely the type of situation or what it means to be an emergency, so this is nonetheless an exigent circumstances. The fact that you could get a warrant or might be able to do so more quickly this day and age doesn't change that fact and that legal conclusion.
I beg your pardon. So exigent describes the scene on the ground rather than availability of a warrant.
Right. Exigent circumstances requires that there is a compelling need for government action or the information in question that the government is seeking, and that there is something else that is more pressing than obtaining a warrant.
So both factors are relevant into the total assessment, is that correct? here's a serious accident, and notwithstanding the potential availability of finding a judge, the seriousness of the accident requires us to go forward. Is that correct?
Right, right. And Mitchell walks through that, how we're not going to put officers in a position where they have to potentially tell medical personnel to hold off on giving immediate treatment so that we can get our warrant first. Or conversely, the medical treatment is going to impinge on our ability to get the warrant. So, I mean, we're not going to put law enforcement in that dilemma, as they phrase, or as they put it. So as long as you have that pressing need, if there's a compelling need for the information, which there always is in DUI cases, and you have a more pressing need than getting a warrant, and really the only two circumstances they laid out were the Schmerber motor vehicle accident and a suspected drunk driver being unconscious and being taken to the hospital, which precludes a breath test being available. But if you have one of those situations, then under SCOTUS's precedent, we have exigent circumstances.
Would the need here to administer fluids, I mean, would that be its own additional circumstance that would provide exigency? And there's some indication here that there was a need to provide, to administer some fluids that might have an impact on Miller's blood alcohol content, right?
Right.
I mean, is that a possible third category of exigency not spelled out by the Supreme Court?
I don't know if it would be a third and separate one. I guess in my head, I would kind of tie that into the whole medical one here that we're dealing with in Mitchell, because there's quite a bit of talk in there about the fact that blood draws are going to take place as part of this medical process. And I think that kind of ties into it. And when I look at their, especially with their final conclusion, they said, we aren't ruling out the unusual case where a situation like this might happen, but the only reason that the person's blood draw is obtained is because law enforcement wants it. And so I guess it's conceivable that somebody could go to a hospital or detox or somewhere like that, and they aren't going to take their blood, and there's not going to be any sort of medical intervention that would affect their BAC. And they're saying, well, in that circumstance, you don't have a more pressing need. You need to get the warrant there. But I think the fact that the evidence in this case established that they were in fact going to administer fluids, that the medical personnel informed law enforcement was likely to affect his BAC, certainly ties into the medical component here in the Mitchell analysis, and certainly bolsters the fact that exigent circumstances existed. I'm well over my time. If there are no further questions, we would ask to confirm the judgment of this court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 1 minute and 8 seconds, Mr. Mulvar.
Thank you, Judge. Two quick things to address Justice Miller Lerman's original question of myself. There was never an attempt to get a warrant. There's multiple law enforcement officers both on the scene and at the hospital. I believe the time frame was somewhere in 90 minutes, something like that. There were certainly resources available to do so. There was never an attempt. My second point, addressing the state's argument about Kliegel's testimony being, you know, just as good, and because of that, there's harmless error. Well, Kliegel's testimony was different than his understanding of what happened in Exhibit 8. He testified as to the definitive answer in front of the jury, but in Exhibit 8, he himself didn't know what was going on. So it's, you know, what he told the jury is very different than what was happening in Exhibit 8. So those are my 2 points. And I have 9 seconds for any questions.
Thank you very much, counsel. This concludes arguments in State versus Miller. You are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Humphrey versus Smith.